Will you pray with me? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts and the joy of this day bring you joy, our God. And may it hold something of the word you want to speak to us, the word we need to hear. O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. The killing of three students near the University of North Carolina this last week seemed at first very far away to me. It was one of those shootings that happens all too often in this country, the kind of thing that makes us shake our heads but doesn't really interrupt our day. But later in the week, I heard a piece on the radio that was recorded last May, just months before this shooting. One of the young women who was killed had recorded a piece on StoryCorps, which is National Public Radio's series that invites regular people to step into a sound booth with another person and to talk about their relationship. The young woman who was killed, Yusor Mohammed Abdusalah, had recorded an interview with her third grade teacher from the Muslim school that she had attended. They spoke with great respect and care for one another, and about how it felt to live as a Muslim in America. Growing up in America has been such a blessing, Yusor said. And you know, in some ways, I do stand out, such as the hijab that I wear on my head, the head covering. But there are so many ways that I feel embedded in the fabric that is our culture. And that's the beautiful thing here, that it doesn't matter where you come from. There's so many different people from so many different places, different backgrounds, all religions. But here we are all one, one culture. Hearing the voice of this young woman and the voice of her teacher who said, "I always knew this student was special," made me experience this week's news story in a different way. Hearing their voices let me feel the completely tragic, senseless loss that happens with hate crimes, when one person hates another simply because they are different. I might have said something similar before, but I would not have felt it in the way that I do now, but for the experience of hearing that hopeful, innocent voice of this 23-year-old young woman who will never speak again. Now, I can tell you about that experience, but I can't give you what I feel because of it. That moment changed my perspective a bit, but it can't really change yours. And that same thing happens, or doesn't happen, when we see a photograph that someone else has taken. It used to be that people only took cameras on their trips away from home, when they were tourists, to record the things that they saw that were out of the ordinary. Now people take pictures of everything, their lunch, the cat sitting in the same place it sits on the sofa every day. They share those photographs on Instagram or Snapchat as if we're trying to share with other people a moment from our own life, an experience that you can get better from a picture than you can with words. But you can't actually pick up how it felt to be in that moment, right? You can look at someone else's pictures from their last vacation and appreciate the beauty of what they saw, but it is almost impossible to capture the awe that they felt when they saw that amazing sunset or that ancient building. You can recognize friends in a photo on Facebook, but that's different from the feeling of being together. To experience something, you have to see it for yourself. The traditional reading for this day in the church year, the Sunday before Lent begins, is the story of Jesus' transfiguration. When he takes three of his disciples up the mountain with him, away from their everyday work and the people who needed something from him almost every minute, and Jesus goes a little ahead of them to the very top of the mountain, and suddenly James and John and Peter see not just one person there, but three. And as much as they know it's impossible, suddenly it looks like Jesus is standing there with Moses and Elijah, the two greatest prophets in Israel's history. It's a powerful moment for them. They know that it says something worth remembering about who Jesus is and the kind of cosmic credibility that he has. There were no cameras, of course, but Peter has the same instinct to build an altar on that spot so that this moment can be preserved and shared. "No," Jesus says, a little sharply. "No altars. Don't even tell anyone about this." Which must have left the disciples looking at each other with question marks on their faces. You want us to see something this dramatic? Experience something that changes our whole sense of who you are and then not tell other people about it? Now, this wasn't the first time that Jesus had surprised them by hushing them up. Just before the story of the Transfiguration is the story that Jimmy read to us this morning. Jesus and his disciples are in Caesarea Philippi, Matthew tells us. And like most of the details in the gospel, this one about place is meant to tell us something. Caesarea Philippi was way off the beaten track for Jews in Jesus' time. It's like Jesus was taking his disciples on a field trip way up north. It's that place circled in red at the top of that map. It was in Gentile country. It was the opposite direction from Jerusalem, which is circled in red toward the bottom. And that was where everybody went to worship God. Jesus took them far away from their home, away from the temple, as if he wanted to separate them from all the right answers. And out there, Jesus asked his disciples, "Who are people saying that I am?" They were able to answer pretty quickly, I imagine. "Well, some people think you're the next John the Baptist, and some are thinking even bigger, like you might even be a prophet as great as Elijah or Jeremiah." But Jesus doesn't seem to have been looking for easy answers or compliments from the crowd. He was looking for something else. An answer that wasn't so conventional, so neatly tied up. And so he asked them, these people who knew him best, who had been with him day in and day out, "Who do you say that I am?" I imagine there was a bit of silence. They knew this was an important question, and they wanted to get the answer right. You are the Messiah, Peter said. You are the Son of the living God. And Jesus praised Peter for this answer, gave him every reason to think that he had seen and identified Jesus accurately. But don't tell anyone, Jesus said. In fact, Matthew's words are even more emphatic than that. The gospel says Jesus sternly ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Why? Maybe it was because that question Jesus asked, "Who do you say that I am?" was a question that Peter could only answer for himself. A question that every person has to answer for him or herself. If Peter had run out and said, I know, I've got the answer, everybody, or if he had built on that Transfiguration Mountain the definitive answer, the definitive altar to the true reality of Jesus, we would be practicing an altogether different kind of religion than the one Jesus was inviting us to. Jesus taught people something about truth, but he never did it by cementing a set of rules or waving around his resume. He communicated his most significant lessons with his presence, where he showed up, who he talked to, the meals he shared, the questions he asked. What he offered people wasn't an official statement or a philosophy. It was an invitation, an opening into a relationship. Who do you say that I am? Now, probably we could, each of us, recite something in answer to that question, something we learned in Sunday school a long time ago, or a line from a creed, or something we read in a book or heard a preacher say in church. But I don't think that's the kind of answer that Jesus was looking for. He really wanted to know, still wants to know, what your answer is after the kind of silence that important questions demand. The kind of pause that suggests not that you're worrying about getting the answer right, but that you're being mindful of your own truth. Because the only answer to this question that matters is the one we have tested with our own experience, the one we have seen and known for ourselves. We can learn about Jesus by reading the Bible, by studying who he was historically, by making ourselves part of a community that is trying to fall into step behind him. But the point of discipleship, of being a follower of Jesus, is not really to learn about him. It's to encounter him in some way, to meet him, to get close enough to hear him ask you, "Who do you say that I am?" Can you hear the mutuality, the relationship that is embedded in that question? It's a question about your experience. You can't answer a question about who Jesus is for you without also answering a question about who you are. The road that we take to a truthful meeting with Jesus is the same road that we take to get to a truthful meeting with ourselves. We will recognize the one who is the Messiah to us when we expose and knock down all our false messiahs, all those things we thought would save us but don't, all those illusions and self-deceptions that we thought could protect us, but but that harm us instead. This is the long process of the Christian spiritual life. It takes us on a field trip outside of our regular patterns until we are close enough to Jesus to hear him ask us, "Who do you say that I am?" And we answer, but more than once, many times. Our answers are not always the same. They shouldn't be. There have been times in my life when the call to wholeness, the model of Jesus, has been about morality and goodness, calling me on the ways that I let myself off the hook far too easily. Other times it has felt like someone was walking ahead of me, giving me courage for the danger ahead. Sometimes I have needed healing and hope. Sometimes I think I see Jesus clearly ahead of me, leaving footsteps that are easy to follow. And at other times, it feels like I have lost the thread entirely. And I'm grateful for the stories of Peter who got it wrong as often as he got it right. As we begin the season of Lent, this coming Ash Wednesday, instead of asking you to give up chocolate or wine, I want to invite you to a more intentional prayer practice. The kind of prayer that is less about listing our needs or disciplining ourselves into positive thinking, and more about paying attention. The kind of prayer that just might transform your perception of reality, open you to a different way of seeing and knowing your own life. Every weekday morning, starting Thursday, at 6 a.m., and every evening, starting Thursday, at 6 p.m., the chapel will be open for 30 minutes of guided prayer and meditation. Now, if you're anything like me, that's more time than you're accustomed to spending at prayer. Stopping at church at the beginning or the end of your workday might seem like a pain in the neck. But Lent is just 40 days, roughly 10% of the days in a year. Maybe not too much to give, to try a different, more soulful way of living. And what if it really did change something? Amen.